So I'm recording this again because technology failed. Phil failed. Complete rank amateur. Tried to record through the Audioboo recording flash app, and we did 27 minutes, and it was all fucking good stuff. Really raw and passionate, and it's exactly what I wanted it to be. We're sitting over on the sofa now, and we've just been chatting, you know, literally like 15, 20 minutes after that, and it's a bit more comfortable now, I think, anyway.
Yeah, and I finished a big can of energy drink.
So she's going to be, I don't know if I've got enough hard drive space, but we're going to hit it anyway. We did 27 minutes, we're going to try for another like half an hour and see if we can get all that stuff back in there, and maybe it'll be a bit more, not that it wasn't on point, because it was on point, but we're going to go for it again. I put 8 questions together. The whole point of this little interview is that I've been bumping into a few people from Nottingham over the last 6 months, and everybody I've bumped into has made me feel like Nottingham is full of creatives, full of passion. There's a lot of shit going down here, like there is in most cities across the country. But the common thing that I've seen is that if you've got the sort of willingness to get on, there's people who are ready to help you get on. And I just wanted to capture some of the rawness of Nottingham and the people who live in and out, you know, striving to get by day, but, you know, trying to create work out of their skills.
There's a lot of stuff out there that's just not recognised, I think.
Totally.
And it's coming, it's bubbling under the surface, and a lot of people are singing off the same page now.
Yeah.
And it's only going to be nice a matter to see. Of time.
I think it's because, like, I don't know if it's because the easiness of life is just, you know, with the money going out of the system, things getting tough. Public sector slashing. It's no different to us. No different to me. You know, that shit's always been hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's not,
no difference to me. Makes no difference.
You know, I'm still skinny as I was before.
I don't think it is that. I think people have looking at the way that it's been fucked up in the past and wanted to change it for the future. And then people are realising that there's not much of a future there unless they do something about it now.
Right.
You know, and the way that things are going money-wise and mortgages and developing and this, that and the other, yeah, I think it, people are just realising that they've got to do something about it, otherwise nothing's going to change within the next 10 years.
Yeah. So I'm sitting on the sofa, we're sitting at the chair and tables over there with Emma. We're calling her Emma today. It's not her real name. We're doing a little bit of an anonymous thing. And I'm not doing that as a protection thing. I just want to make you think. You know, I just like, who is this person? Because actually, when you start to get to know her through this audio, like, the rawness of a person comes out in audio. And I want you to experience that. And if you're smart enough and you're clever enough, you'll find out who it is.
Yeah.
That's what I'm looking for. Is people who's that? What's that?
You know what, though? I'm not too difficult to hunt down, really.
Really?
Think about it. If you wanted to find out who it was, it wouldn't be difficult to find.
I guess. Well, everybody knows where I am, so they know where I'm broadcasting this from.
Yeah.
So I've got 8 little questions. And again, the reason why I'm doing this podcast, this little audio segment, is I'm trying to capture from all sections of society across Nottingham, from raw passion sort of podcast to, you know, middle class to top end. And I'm trying to set a communication channel between all of them, because they've all got different reasons why they do what they do. But we're in a difficult time now, and we've always been in a difficult time in my headspace. But I think we've got to get people talking. We've got to get people talking and being genuine from where they're coming from why they do the things they do. So I've got 8 questions. And they're meant to be sort of quite probing questions, because I want to find out from your sort of perspective of where you've come from.
Yeah, okay.
So the first one is, tell me your earliest memory as a child growing up in Nottingham.
Of Nottingham, well.
Of Nottingham.
Moved to Nottingham when I was 13. So my first kind of secondary school experience, if you like, was Nottingham. I was born in Sutton in Ashfield in King's Mill, which is an old mining town. It's all, like, you know, middle-aged white people, you know, and still quite a racist attitude, if you want. Or I don't think it's a racist attitude as much as a fear of the unknown.
Yeah.
So I was slammed into this really run-down school, which is now shut down. Well, so the year I left, it kind of shut down because it was that shit. So, you know, it's like perspex windows.
Shit.
And we had the tables and the chairs screwed onto the floor and stuff like that.
Do you think that affects your learning generally anyway?
Oh, you couldn't learn there if you wanted to, honestly. Yeah. You just go there because you go for a piss take, basically. Yeah. But I walked into this school and I realised, shit, I'm white, I'm British, and I'm a minority.
Yeah, yeah.
I had no kind of clue how to relate to these people. Am I allowed to say you're black?
Yeah, yeah.
Am I allowed to say you're Asian? Can I not, like, breach that, you know, can I not come to that in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that was the biggest like memory, that was the biggest thing for me coming to Nottingham, is just a massive culture shock, and realizing that, you know, it's a lot of people going about racism, like geared towards, like, you know, if you're Muslim or if you're black or if you're this or if you're that, and it's not, it's so not like that anymore. It's actually racism is developing now, you know. It's like, it's the black kids will pick on the Somalian kids, for example. They don't like them, and you know, so it's like, and the Asian kids pick on the white kids, and it's completely jumbled up, you know, and just realising the whole mess that that whole thing, that whole politics has kind of got into, and just realising the kind, I don't know, the etiquette around communicating with people from, like, massive different backgrounds and stuff. Yeah, that's quite scary. Learning curve for me, but yeah.
So would you say that, you know, the school system, in a way, has been broken for a long time?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So talking about school, you know, what was your school life like? You know, I mean, you said you were the minority at 13 with going to the school, and it was full of, like, mixed race, and there was quite a tension there, I can well imagine.
Yeah.
Not only from the bloody things being screwed to the floor and stuff, but, you know, what was it like?
Well, I went for about a year, and then I figured out that I couldn't learn anything if I wanted to, and I was always one of these kids that was, I was viewed as very much a disruptive child, because I'd find things boring. If I didn't see the point in attending a lesson, I wouldn't go. Like religious education. And one of the things I couldn't stand was people teaching me their opinions as facts. So I'd very much challenge that. And the teachers did not like that. And then they were stressed enough because they never had enough money and this, that and the other. So I'd kind of stopped going. I stopped going about 14, 15, and spent most of my time down in one of the local pubs with all the old folks playing card games, like 13 card brag and Kukan and cribbage and stuff, and I'd take me £3 in the money, and I'd come back with 15 quid where I'd won and stuff like that.
So you were pretty much an entrepreneur from like 15, weren't you, really?
Yeah.
Straight into it.
Well, I smoked as well at school, so what I'd do as well is I'd be about 13, 14 when I started smoking, and I'd take me £3 to the fag man at the end of the road, buy a packet of 20 fags, and I'd sell them for 50p a fag. So then that kind of, like, got me my fags for the next day, my dinner, and the next day, and the next day, and kind of went around that, and I had quite a sum of pocket money by the weekend.
Do you think it's like, you know, was it because, like, the school classes had, like, lots of kids in it, or just they were ill prepared to deal with the kind of personality and character that you were? You know, has this stuff been bubbling away for a long, long time?
Yeah, and I think both. There are too many kids. There's certain things you can't... A spade's a spade, like I said to you before, you know. There's certain things you can't say, you know. And you, the poor teachers, I mean, I do feel for them in a way, because they're just so hemmed in. Like, all a kid has to say is the word racist, and that's it. The teacher's terrified for the jobs then, you know. It's like, you've been removed from class. What, is it because I'm black? They can't do anything, you know. They can't... put it, you know, you can't keep a kid in detention, they can't physically detain, they can't do anything. But I think the way that they talk to teachers is entirely wrong as well, because they're just teaching things as facts instead of, you know, I think teaching is about getting somebody to then ask more questions, rather than saying this is black, this is white, this is grey. You know, ask them questions that then, you know, get them to ask more questions.
More than
get them involved and show them the interest, and also teach them things about that they're interested in as well, and that sort of thing.
So people listening to this, you know, would probably go, well, actually, no, that doesn't make a lot of sense, because you sort of dropped out of school, so you weren't sort of learning this, that and the other. But I look at it from the perspective that you were hanging out with these older people who sort of have seen life, been around life, then probably been to school at some point in their life. You weren't getting what you wanted out of it. You felt like somebody was standing on your opinions, you know, because you can make your own, you were strong enough to make your own.
Yeah, you weren't encouraged to ask questions.
Right.
And I think that's a hell of a lot about learning. Unfortunately, I'm not one of these people who can just accept things. I have to kind of dig. But, no, I think I did learn a lot, you know. I'm not stupid. But, you know, I read a lot of books, but I read the stuff that I wanted to learn. And these older people are extremely intelligent, who have been through the lives, and some of them are retired accountants. And I befriended one in particular who was a retired accountant, but his wife died of MS, and he became an alcoholic and brought the kids up on his own, and sadly passed away, bless him, because he had throat cancer. But you know, we used to sit there, we used to read the Times and all the broadsheets, and if there's a question, you know, and we used to do the cryptic crosswords and things like that. So he kind of taught me as well a lot about vocabulary and language and things like that, and doing all the puzzles and maths and stuff.
Do you think we have a cross section of society that we're not servicing? As in, we have a lot of people who need to be educated, and some people are just social. They can hang around some people, and that's how they learn.
Yes.
We're not accommodating those sort of people, and that actually
some
creates.
Some people are curious, like me. I think intelligence for me is curiosity and a good memory.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is, and I suppose applying it as well. But that's a different. But yeah, I think my education, I very much managed it myself. You know, I was good at exams. I'd go back into school for the exams I had to do and pass them with flying colours, because I retained the information very easily, and I found it, I was just very thirsty for knowledge. And, you know, and it was never enough to say, right, this is, that goes up, this comes down. I'd then want to know why, and I'd dig deeper and dig deeper, and the teachers could not kind of give me the answers to that. So I just thought, well, sod it. And, you know, so I'd read books about it and like watch documentaries and things like that, and ask the older people as well about their life experiences, and yeah, I just really,
it made up your identity. So coming out of those sort of school years that you sort of didn't go, and then you were hanging down at the pub and stuff, what were the sort of years from like 16 to 20 like?
Well, just before I was 16, unfortunately, I didn't have a very good upbringing as far as parents are concerned. I mean, usually you at least get one good one. Well, I've got two bad ones, really.
Okay.
One was an alcoholic, and the other one was severely mentally ill.
Okay.
So I kind of had to be put into like what was called placements as foster care for a few months until I turned 16, which I never kind of stayed there anyway, because I always thought...
How did that make you initially feel?
Shit. Oh, fucking hell. It was a hard lesson to learn. I think a lot of people don't learn that lesson until like the parents die when you're older or something. But I was actually on my own. There was no safety net for me then, you know. It's like your parents or your grandparents or your family is supposed to be your safety net if you're fucked up. And at 16, to kind of think, shit, I'm on my own, do you know what I mean?
Mm.
And what I do is my safety net. So if I don't earn, I don't eat, kind of thing.
Mm.
But so I kind of locked myself up. They put me in a project when I was 16, which is like a housing association hostel thing. And I kind of locked myself away for 3 months, read a lot of books, didn't come out of my little hostel flat thing, and got a bit down about it. And then you know, because I wanted to work and I wanted to go to college and I wanted to learn and do things like that, but you couldn't do it there. You can't do it in that circumstance, because in order to pay for the support, I mean, nobody can be thrown out on the street at 16 years old, move into a house and know how to run their life.
Sure.
You need guidance. So that place was then staffed by support workers, which is all well and good, but in order to pay rent to live in that place that is staffed by support workers that support you in sorting out your bills and this, that and the other and what you do next and supporting you emotionally about growing up and things,
mm-hmm.
You have to pay the premium for that. So the rent to live in a place like that is about £150 a week. So in order to pay that, you then have to be on benefits. So if I went and got a job at 16 where the wage was like £3.20 an hour back then, I think,
mm-hmm.
How could I afford to do that? I couldn't. So I lasted about 3 months and I had a little suitcase, and I just thought, do you know what? Sod it. I'm not going to be tied into the system. I packed my little suitcase over my shoulder, left everything behind, got my 30 quid dole money that I got, and just got on the train and went to Nottingham and knocked on a door of one of my parents' old friend of a friend and just hoped to God they were in, and was like, have you got a spare sofa? So at 16, I kind of went down to one of the local pubs, told them I was 18. Well, I mean, this person's house I was staying at, I told him I was 18 and that, because I've always been quite social like that and tall for my age and stuff.
Yeah.
So and got a job working cash in hand behind a bar. So I was doing about 70 hours a week for a fiver an hour. And I was doing that all right up until I was 18.
Right. So you went through this sort of transitional period in your life there. There's a lot of shit happened, usual sort of teenage things that happen. You got all the sort of mental things going on about the parents, so you're taking out a baggage with you and sorting that out in your own head. So there must have been sort of relationships back then, you know, who broke your heart?
Oh, well, my heart didn't get broken until I was 22. I think you've had those like kind of infatuations and you've lived with guys and you've been in relationships and you thought it was the end of the world when when you were like in between the ages of 16 and 18. But I think when you get to your 20s, I mean, it's probably an older thing for guys because, you know, guys apparently mature slower than women and stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's totally right. That's totally right.
Yeah, I got to about, I was working in a club. I was UAC in a club, which is quite a good job. Again, I've always blagged my way completely into whatever job that I've ever had. And God knows how I landed this job, but I was doing all right, do you know what I mean? 20-odd and about 22, 25k a year. You know, I was like completely financially controlling this massive super club unit. Fuck knows how I blagged my way into it, but I did. Quite proud of myself, do you know what I mean? And then I just sat there once I'd done it and I thought, God, I'm like working for the enemy. You know, it's like, what am I doing? I don't need all this money, I don't need this, I don't need that. So I decided to jack that in and took a bit of a sabbatical, if you like, down to London with a friend of mine that's a model.
Right.
For about, I think we were supposed to go for a week, we ended up being there about 3 months.
Yeah.
Just in and around London.
So how do you adapt and change down in London? You know, like, does it make you more northern?
Yes, very much so. Because she'd like roped me into a bit of this modelling stuff and everything, which I never took too seriously. I thought, oh, I'll have some nice photos to show my kids when I'm old. Like, there, looky, mum.
Yeah. I did do something, here it is.
Look how that's where you get your looks from, kids. You know what I mean? But, I'd go to like, it was around the time when Ed Hardy, you know Ed Hardy, mm-hmm, that kind of fashion thing, mm-hmm, was launching. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, with the, he kind of looks like tattoos and rhinestones and all that chaviness.
Okay.
He was launching in a place called Mavida, which is a really nice. It was supposed to be a really nice club to be. It's just overpriced and pretentious, but you know.
Okay.
So me being me, you know, I'd sit at these tables that cost like 500 quid a whack to buy, and you'd have all these middle class girls like drinking champagne and this, that and the other, and they'd be like, would you like a drink, Tanya? And I'd be like, yeah, I'll have a pint up. You know, so I always feel like I'm representing wherever I am. So I'm more northern when I go down south, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's terrible. And you notice that people kind of fear it as well. Which I found hilarious.
But that comes down to that geography thing again, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. If you know the Watford Gap, that's it.
Yeah, I call it the M25 force field.
I say if you're from like London, you look at the M20, you've got a map in your head, and there's the M25, and outside of that it says here they'd be dragons.
Yeah. I like that. So we didn't get onto the sort of who broke your heart. So I guess it was somebody down there in London.
Yeah, well, we're in between shoots and we'd been to a club called Faces in Gants Hill, mm-hmm, which is a Essex kind of club, and all the stars go there and all that bollocks. Yeah. And my mate met Jermaine Defoe, and that's another story. Stuff like that, and which I didn't really buy. I just wanted to get pissed and have a bit of a dance and have a good time, me.
Yeah.
But, we've been into Gants Hill, we're staying at mates, and we finished that, and we're going to a shoot in Paddington. So we're waiting for the tube and everything on the Central Line, and walked into this place in Gants Hill called The Bar, and there was this guy there, and he was slagging off bloody women. So I thought, I'm not having any of that. And me becoming more northern when I'm down south, well, that means I've come a lot more rowdy. So without having to be drunk or anything, I turned around and went, excuse me, and he started off slagging me, so I clapped him one and took him right good backhander, because we were arguing about this women thing, this problem. And then we just got talking from then, and there's chemistry, and we got invited to a house party, and we ended up staying there for 3 months, and then eventually I ended up moving down to London, and he was in the military, and he was half Egyptian. So he spoke quite fluent Arabic and stuff. So he originally just went into the signals. But as soon as they clocked on to the fact that he spoke Arabic, that was it. They attached him to a human unit, which was a bit like SAS Special Forces kind of thing. Human resources kind of thing, where they'd source people. They'd travelled in a six-man unit, you know, in civvies, travelling, collecting sources and doing lots of nasty things and stuff like that. So I was living down there, and he decided to leave that because it wasn't doing him any good. And he put his CV on Monster, as you do, and got a reply just about a couple of days before he was going to withdraw his resignation because he never thought he'd get a job. And it was the Foreign and Commonwealth Office offering him a job in Basra to be the interpreter for the ambassador over there, which he ended up being the acting media officer and this, that and the other. So I said, right, okay, if you're kind of bogging off for 6 weeks at a time, do you know what I mean, and only coming back for two, I'm moving back up north. So we got this really plush apartment on Castlegate opposite the wine merchants, bang on. And
Andy,
yeah, you know. And he kind of bogged off for like 6 weeks and came back for two, and the money was almost frigging ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? And I had massive, like, biggest telly you've ever seen, do you know what I mean? Because I'd never seen money like that before. Mm.
So you had to deal with a lot of stuff in a short space of time, didn't you? Mm. So, because of all that stuff happening, what sort of the driving force in you now that makes you strive for better? How I mean, obviously, you've developed that from hanging out with people, throwing yourself at situations like, right, I'm off down to London, I'm going to do this, I'm going to go and work, you know, I'm just going to do what I'm good at, I'm going to adapt around these sort of people. What keeps you going like that day to day?
Well, again, I think it comes back to education and things like that. So what if I've not got any GCSEs or I've not got a degree or all this, that and the other? Why can't I kind of build a business or fill a niche that's needed or be heard?
Mm.
Why not? You know, a lot of people said to me when I was barking on my most recent project that, oh no, you can't do that, you can't write business plans, you can't do this, you can't do that, and my kind of response to that was, why can't I? You know, it's like, no, I can't write a business plan, you're right, so what did I do? I took myself on a course to learn how to do it. And also just coming from the bad side of things as well, and never wanting anybody else to have to slip through the net that I did. And the thing that I'm doing at the minute is creative arts and focusing on like 16 to 24 vulnerable adults, especially homeless section as well, because that's massive.
Huge.
And I think that it's really important that there is a creative outlet, and especially that the government are kind of looking to social enterprises and creative arts and things like that to kind of save the economy in a little bit. And yeah, just kind of filling that void. And I wish that somebody had given me kind of a creative outlet when I was going through my times and things like that, because I think it's very important, and there's a lot of talent there as well. But it's kind of beaten out with us with the system, I think.
Would you say that sort of in your sort of days growing up, you know, the world was obviously a lot different place than it is now. There was money floating about, even though we might not have had access to it. You know, we sort of ducked and dived and did what we needed to do. The world's changed a lot now. It's a lot more broken. We know more about it because the news is shouting about it. There's a lot of stuff that doesn't make it to the news that still goes on. You know, there's no money in the system. The people that were just getting by are really struggling to get by now.
Yeah,
there's a lot of things broken. What do you see on a daily basis?
Jesus. I mean, the same problems that Nottingham always had are still there. This, you know, and you don't have to be involved with like a gangstery side of things just to see it, because Nottingham is such a compacted area. You just have to keep your eyes open and your ears open. It's like prostitution, for example. They're cleaning it up, they're cleaning it up on the streets and things, but then they're just forcing people in towards escort agencies, which are technically legal. You know, it's like the cartel thing when they, you know, because there's always been a gang problem in Nottingham ever since way back when. The book Hoods is really good for that. You can read it right back from when Lord Snot and Snottingham all the way up to when the guns were sent to prison in 2007, I think, somewhere like that. But now they've cleaned that up. What's the next biggest problem is that people are trying to fill that gap. And then you've got, like, the Middle Eastern influences and stuff. So it's, and you know, and then there was a stigma called Shottingham as well, when we were called Shottingham. Well, do you know what? That problem's still not changed. It's just not on the news. Because, like, where I come from, I know of people still getting shot and stabbed and killed and things like that, but it's not on the news. Because why is it not on the news? Because it caused problems with tourism. You know? It's still the same problem.
So, as an outsider, you know, How does a council not necessarily fix this stuff, but how does a council realistically, you know, move away from this culture of chucking loads of money, which they now don't have? You know, they can't set up community centres because, you know, they get graffitied up or they get burnt down because their message is wrong. Do you agree, or would you maybe suggest that having brand ambassadors from local areas, from NG1 to up to 7, 8, whatever it may be, you know, the people who are at the cutting edge of these problems, you know, if they could set up a communication line with the local council, say, you know what, I know these people in this area, I know what they're going through, we need to educate other people what I'm going through. Do you think that would be a better way?
Right, I think the councils and the education system and the way that they're tackling teenage pregnancy and blah blah blah, they know that it's done through education. But, like, a woman that I'm kind of helping out at the minute is being employed by the council to make arts accessible to the deprived areas of Nottingham, like St Anne's and Radford and what have you. But she's middle class. She's got a BA Honours in Fine Art. And she's about 50 years old. Now, walking into the middle of St Anne's, going, hello, you know, I really want to introduce you to this artist, blah, blah. I'm not going to listen to him.
No.
You know, the education, yeah, it's done through education, but they're looking in the wrong places.
And the delivery's wrong.
Yeah, the delivery is completely wrong. You know, it's like they need to use the people that are up and coming and doing something off their own backs. I mean, because with what I'm doing with the creative arts and stuff, I'm not getting paid for. I've just got bugger all to lose, you know.
Mm. So elaborate on what you're trying to do. I think that's a really interesting thing that you've got to get out there.
What I'm trying to do is we're working with an already successful community-run studio, which was set up by a 20-year-old lad, again, with no formal qualifications, etc., etc. Bless him, he's like put himself through uni and he's so proud of him. But, you know, and we've got like almost like a what we're doing already, we've got almost like a shop in Hockley, and we get young designers come through, you know, well, not even designers, but people who are good at art and have that creativity about them, come through from areas like St Anne's and Meadows and places like that, and they put stuff in our shop to then sell on, which is sustaining them, which then buys them material so they can carry on doing what they're doing. Now what I want to do is expand the music side of things into arts and design and make that, you know, accessible to all as well, because I think when you're going through shit when you're that age, it's very, very important that you have that kind of outlet, you know, something to do with your time. Let's be creative. Not everybody wants to sing or write music. Some people like might want to do theatre and dance and things like that. Anything that's kind of expressive is really important. And yeah, that's basically what we're trying to do. We're just trying to make it bigger, and eventually, you know, because there's so many little projects around Nottingham that are doing the same thing with the studios and with the arts and with this and with that, and eventually when this initially is off the ground, then what I want to finally do is kind of like get us all together in some kind of foundation, so we have to be listened to then by the council, and I want it to be run by the people again that have grown up in these areas, that have seen the things that I've seen, that have experienced the things that I've seen, so they can be respected by the people that then come to them, and so on and so forth, and just educate people by the people that have already come from their areas and their backgrounds and stuff. And
so be more realistic, really. I mean, it's like being more realistic. Instead of chucking gobs of money at a community and social projects, start to listen, you know, start to develop the channels to be able to listen more. You know, highlight these people. Give them a platform to sort of speak about this stuff, be it audio, video, or whatever it may be. Another question leading on to that, really. So maybe, I don't know if it's about money, but maybe a councillor or maybe a local project or some kind of lottery fund or grant or whatever. They write a blank check and they say, you know, how would you like to start to fix things in these areas? You know, you've got Hockley, you've got Snenton. What would you do? I mean, you've got this great little project anyway, which you're sort of doing very organically and growing up. But if somebody just sort of give you a 5K or a 20K injection tomorrow, how would you go about that? What would you do with that?
What would I do with it? I'd develop the studio more. I'd make it more accessible to people. I'd kind of, the big thing for me as well is the designers that were already established and some of the students that go to uni that are talented, I want to bring them in to do, get the classes mixing, get people mixing, get somebody down there talking about fine art with the music as well. They all love rap and stuff like that, so to get to the base of it, that's what you need to do with education. You need to spark people's interest, because you know there would be no hip hop and rap without like R&B, which is original rhythm and blues, and then you've got soul and jazz, and it's just giving people something they're interested in. But you know, as far as I think the biggest problem is that the people out there are not being listened to that are starting these community projects and going around trying to make things accessible and stuff like that, is because it's not being done in the right way by the right people that come from the same areas, basically. It's very much us and them kind of thing. And I think basically what the council and what like projects like mine are trying to do, or ours are trying to do, is we're saying the same shit. We've just got a completely different language about it. So I think somebody needs to bridge that gap and just supply a way in which, you know, I mean, for me, I've had, you know, it's going to take me about 6 months to learn how to write a business proposal and what lingo I need to use on funding applications and things like that. It would be great for me if I could go to the council and say, look, you know, I've got this that's already effectively a social enterprise, you know, it deserves funding. We're already supplying the materials and the tutoring off our own back to these young designers, we want to expand it, we want to do this, we want to do that, because the passion is there.
Mm.
But now I've got to spend 6 months learning how to write it down on paper.